Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do we need to understand about climate change in order to respond to it appropriately, and what factors will remain beyond our control? Given the widespread misconceptions about the relationship between climate, weather, and human activity, the nonpartisan science journalism organization Climate Central decided to create an easy-to-digest primer summarizing what scientists have learned in recent years and what they are still trying to figure out. Michael Lemonick is senior science writer for Climate Central and co-author of the new book Global Weirdness: Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What are the indications for scientists that the kind of weird weather we've experienced in recent years is somehow different from the, air quotes here, natural weather that our ancestors experienced?
Well, the best way to look at it is that, you know, as you suggest, there was weird weather, there was extreme weather in the time of our ancestors. Heat waves in the summer are not a new thing. Droughts are not a new thing. We've had those forever. Severe storms as well. And what scientists have to look at is whether the frequency of these events and the severity of these events is changing. So if you get a heat wave in July, it's just doesn't mean anything. If you get a lot of heat waves and they last longer and they're more intense than they used to be, which is what seems to be happening, then you have an indication that something is affecting that climate we're used to. And we think that's human emissions of greenhouse gases.
Why is there so much ongoing debate, in fact, more debate now about climate change, even though the tide of scientific opinion seems to have changed and agreed that what is happening is, in fact, affected by human activity?
I think the reason is that there are, while there are actually very few scientists who work on climate change who doubt that we're affecting the climate, there are a few, and there are political and economic forces that have a stake in having that be true. People who worry that their personal business or their economy or their political fortunes might suffer if we start to take climate change seriously. And it's that combination of people motivated not to to believe this stuff and a few scientists that they can call on to support them that has led to this this support. And there's also, in this country, a very long tradition of self-reliance and keeping the government out of our business, and you know it's kind of an American value. And so when you have a situation where it might be that the government says no, you can't buy a car that gets 2 miles to the gallon, or you can't spew as much pollution as you want into the air, it goes against that value that we should be able to do what we want.
You know, also when you talk, Michael, about self-reliance, there is the idea that we, you know, what we see is what we get, that we can observe this and then make decisions. But it turns out that we can't, as non-scientists, we can't really apply common sense to the weather we're experiencing and evaluate the existence of climate change.
That's absolutely right. We you know, our own instincts, well, first of all, I think it's common sense that the Earth is so big and the atmosphere is so huge and the climate has changed so drastically in the past, long before we came on the scene, that it just doesn't make any sense that we could affect something as great as the Earth's climate system. But that instinct is wrong, and science shows that it's wrong. We also have that reaction that heat waves are normal or storms are normal, and you know, in Grandpa's day, I mean, back in the 1930s, we had the Dust Bowl. Mm-hmm. So, big deal. These things happen. And again, that's a reasonable assumption based on personal experience, but it just doesn't get at the actual truth.
So there have been times in the Earth's history when there was as much CO2 in the atmosphere as we have today. Last time was, half a million years ago. What was the Earth like at that point?
The carbon in the atmosphere has gone up and down over the past nearly a million years for natural reasons, and it's quite clear that when carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is high, the Earth is warmer. So the periods in between ice ages, you see high carbon dioxide, you see high temperatures. During the ice ages, the carbon dioxide goes very low and temperatures go very low. You have to go back several million years before the Earth was, before you find that the Earth was warm for many millions of years at a time. If you go back to the time of the dinosaurs, 65 million years ago, there was much more carbon dioxide in the air, and the climate was so warm all over the Earth that there was essentially no ice, even in the high Arctic. Sea level was a couple hundred feet higher than it is now, and you had tropical plants and tropical animals, crocodiles, living in Greenland. So that's kind of the relationship that scientists have figured out between greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and climate. And it seems pretty consistent through the ages.
Talk about some of the things that people have suggested might be responsible for climate change that have nothing to do with human activity. Some people say, well, there's some variability in the sun. There are volcanoes or eruptions that happen or don't happen from year to year. What have scientists learned about all that?
Well, so that's a very good question. That gets back to your point about common sense and common experience. You know, the sun is responsible for our entire climate. All of the heat that keeps us alive and causes plants to grow and so on comes from the sun. And so it's absolutely natural and sensible to point to the sun as the first possible culprit in climate change. And scientists know the sun does get warmer and does get cooler by a little bit, and that can have a big effect on the climate. And so the first thing you have to think of when you see the temperature rising is, well, isn't it likely that the sun is responsible? So then what a scientist does is say, yeah, that makes sense. Let's go check it out. And so they observe the sun. They've observed the sun for the last 100 years or so and made pretty careful measurements, especially in the last 40 or 50 years. And it turns out that what makes common sense turns out not to be true. The sun has not gotten brighter over that time period. The sun's variations can't really explain our changes in climate. So that's an obvious suspect, but we've ruled that out. You also look at volcanic eruptions, as you mentioned. Volcanoes have the opposite effect. So when they go off and they throw a lot of dust up into the air, they actually cool the climate. They shield the Earth from the rays of the sun. Excuse me. And they cool things down. Mount Pinatubo did that in the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
So you go and, again, you say, yeah, that makes sense. Let's go and check. Are we having fewer volcanoes, which means that there will be less shielding from the sun over the past 100 years? What are the statistics on volcanoes? And again, it turns out that's not the explanation. Good thought, good suspect, but we've ruled that suspect out.
What's the best way to understand the effects of carbon dioxide on the Earth's climate? You describe it as acting like a sort of sweatsuit for the planet.
Yeah, and it's also known as the greenhouse effect. And the greenhouse is another good analogy, not a perfect one. But what happens is simply that sunlight comes through the Earth's atmosphere. You look up, there's the sun, it's shining brightly, it illuminates the Earth. The rays of the sun pass easily through our atmosphere to warm up the surface. And when the surface gets warm, it sends out its own radiation in the form of infrared rays. When you put on a pair of night vision goggles, say if you're a soldier or something like that, and you look at night, you actually see this glow of infrared radiation coming off of warm objects like people and like land and like trees. And that infrared radiation goes back out into space. You know, if all of the energy we got from the sun stayed here, we would heat up to an intolerable temperature. So a lot of it comes in, a lot of it goes back out, and we're in balance. What happens with greenhouse gases like CO2, carbon dioxide, is that they prevent some of this infrared light from escaping. So it gets trapped, and the Earth warms up. We're no longer in balance. We're no longer sending out as much energy as we used to. And so the temperature gradually builds up. And we know this is true, first of all, because it was tested in laboratories way back in the 1800s. It's absolutely an established fact that carbon dioxide blocks this invisible heat-carrying infrared radiation. We also can look at the planet Venus, which has a very thick atmosphere made mostly of carbon dioxide, and it turns out the temperature on Venus, on the surface, is something like 800 degrees Fahrenheit.
Not that much closer to the sun than we are, relatively speaking, but that much hotter.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So part of that is, you're right, it is accounted for by the fact that they're closer to the sun, but most of it comes from the fact that that Venus has a carbon dioxide atmosphere which traps heat. If you look out the other way at Mars, the surface of Mars is below freezing, it's absolutely frigid. But we know that a couple billion years ago, Mars was not frigid. It was warm enough that rivers could flow, oceans could form. We see ancient seabeds on Mars. And the only reasonable explanation for that is that Mars once had an atmosphere that had greenhouse gases that kept it warm enough. And because Mars is a small planet, it gradually lost that atmosphere over time. It can no longer trap the heat necessary to keep the temperatures up, and so it's frozen.
So the Earth has some natural mechanisms that allow it to sort of warehouse carbon dioxide. Talk about where those are and why climate change actually keeps them from functioning properly.
Well, so I talked about the heat system of the Earth being in balance, but the atmosphere has also been in pretty much rough balance for many hundreds of thousands of years. Natural processes like, again, volcanoes or the death and decay of plant material release carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So we're always adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, we meaning the Earth, mm-hmm. in a natural way. And natural vacuum cleaners, you might call them, then take it back out again, and those include plants, again, which grow and absorb carbon dioxide as part of their growth process. There are also minerals that absorb carbon dioxide. So limestone, for example, very gradually draws carbon dioxide in from the atmosphere. And those things have been roughly in balance, so that the level of carbon dioxide, you add some, you take some away, you add some, you take some away, for the last at least 10,000 years, it's been in balance. And we've now started adding artificial carbon dioxide by burning fossil fuels, but those absorbing systems haven't changed. They're just absorbing at the same rate they always did. And so that balance is upset. Moreover, there are some systems, like the ocean, which also absorbs carbon dioxide, that are less able to do it now. So, and that's because as water gets warmer, it can absorb less CO2. So a lot of the CO2 we've been emitting since the 1800s has gone into the oceans. The oceans are having a harder and harder time drawing that in. So not only have we not added new ways to remove carbon dioxide, we've actually done harm to existing systems.
Michael Lemonick. Oh, go ahead.
No. I'm just going to keep blathering.
You're doing great. Michael Lemonick is my guest. He's senior science writer with the nonpartisan science journalism organization Climate Central, and he's co-author of a new book called Global Weirdness: Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. You can join this conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior science writer with the nonpartisan science journalism organization Climate Central, Michael Lemonick. He's co-author of the new book Global Weirdness: Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. So, Michael, we say fossil fuels. People know that means coal and oil and gas. But it turns out in terms of contributing to greenhouse gases, not all fossil fuels are created equal.
That's certainly true. So coal emits by far the most carbon dioxide for the amount of energy you get out of it. Gasoline comes after that, and natural gas emits about half as much per unit of energy as coal.
And there are other forms of energy that we're very excited about now. There's wind, there's solar, things that don't contribute to the existence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But at this point, we can't make enough of them to power the planet in the way we've become accustomed to.
That's right. We don't have the production capacity, first of all. It's also the case that coal especially is still cheaper. Mm-hmm. Than these alternatives, and people don't want to spend more money if they don't have to. Yet another problem with these renewable sources of energy is that at nighttime the sun's not shining. On a calm day, the wind is not blowing. So these are considered intermittent sources of electricity, and you have to have some kind of backup for having power at night or on a calm day. So they are imperfect. There is no solution that is perfect, really.
Why are different parts of the Earth affected at different rates by climate change?
Well, it has to do with all sorts of things. It has to do with ocean currents. Oceans transport enormous amounts of heat from one part of the Earth to another. And so... The Gulf Stream, for example, keeps the northern coast of Europe, England and France, places like that, much warmer than they have any right to be. The Arctic, in particular, is warming much faster than the rest of the planet, and that's largely due to the fact that as ice starts to melt in the Arctic, the bright reflective surface of the ice gives way to darker land underneath or to ocean, which is also darker, and that dark surface absorbs more heat. So you lose some of the reflective power that bounces the sun's energy back out into space, and you start absorbing heat rather than reflecting it, and that creates kind of a feedback loop that accelerates the warming in that part of the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hey, I was wondering. I remember in grade school learning during the Viking times, climate was much warmer. They could grow wheat in Greenland and grapes in Newfoundland. And as you said, climate change changes the climate in various areas. You can grow, say, wheat in higher latitudes, some places are warmer. I'm wondering, why is it that I haven't heard a good argument why the temperature right now is somehow the optimal temperature for human beings to live, when in the past, say in the Viking times, it was much, much warmer, and polar bears seem to have survived that time as humans in general. So why is it that we think that the temperature right now, what we have right now, is somehow the only optimal temperatures for humans to live in?
Excellent question. And the answer is we don't. We don't think this is the optimal temperature. We know that humans have done well in when it was warmer. We know that they survived all the way through the ice ages when it was a lot colder. It's not a question of what's optimal. It's a question of the fact that our modern civilization, with 7 billion people living in major cities with an enormous amount of investment in infrastructure, our coastal cities are on the coast, Our grain growing areas are in a particular part of the Midwest, and we would do fine if those things were in different places. The problem is they're not. And so as sea level rises, for example, you know, if you were, if it was 10,000 years ago, you could pick up your tent and your camels and move inland. You can't pick up New York City or Houston and move inland. We've got all of this infrastructure in place. You can't pick up the farms in the Midwest and move them to Canada just because the weather's better in Canada, because you've got enormous amount of investment and infrastructure and people living in places where it's currently good to live. And that's what makes the problem so worrisome. It's that we have attuned our living to the current, to the conditions that have been around for the past number of thousands of years. And if those things change quickly, which they are, you can't just pick up and recreate the planet overnight. It's extremely, extremely disruptive and expensive, fantastically expensive. But your basic question is a good one. No, it's not like this is the best temperature. It's just the one we are accommodated to.
How does the speed of that change affect the ability of wildlife to adapt?
Well, we've got our infrastructure. Wildlife has its ecosystems and its preferred habitats, and it is a lot easier for animals to move a few miles north if the temperature starts changing, or move uphill. The problem is that ecosystems are made up of many, many, many organisms that all kind of work together. They eat each other and they grow from each other, and they've got this mutual relationship that's evolved over many thousands of years. And as the climate changes, some of them are more mobile than others. It's, deer can, run 10 miles north in a couple of days. Trees can't do that. So if the climate changes, if the growing, the optimal growing location changes faster than trees can send out new seedlings, those trees can't keep up. There are different animals, even if you're just talking about animals, that are more resilient to climate change. They don't have to move. Gets a little hotter, that's okay with them. Others are very sensitive, and they do have to move. And so a number of organisms, plants, and animals of different kinds that are used to living together and working with each other, some of them leave because they can. Some don't leave because they can't. And so the ecosystem itself is torn apart. There are actually instances of this that have already been seen when migrating birds, for example, in some parts of Europe, they're pretty resilient. So the climate starts to change, but they still arrive in their summer feeding grounds at about the same time each year. But the emerging caterpillars that they are used to finding waiting for them, well, they emerged 2 weeks ago and they're gone. There are now butterflies. And so that relationship where the insects emerge and the birds arrive and the birds eat the insects, that's disrupted. And it's all of those relationships between species that's the most sensitive to climate change.
We have an email here from Brian in Wiley who says, from what I understand, the glaciers in Glacier Bay, Alaska, were receding in the days of Captain James Cook. Is the Earth warming naturally and due to anthropogenic influences?
That is a wonderful question. I'm glad to hear it. People make the sort of assumption that if the climate is changing, it's either because humans are doing it or because it's natural. It's either or. It's not at all true. Both things go on at the same time. The climate has warmed naturally. The caller earlier who talked about it being warm in Greenland, mm-hmm. When the Vikings were out, that was during something known as the medieval warm period, a natural climate variation where at least parts of the northern hemisphere warmed up a bit and then went back down. So these natural cycles and these human-created changes in climate are happening at the same time, and they overlap with each other, if we were just in a laboratory and you cranked up the CO2 and didn't change anything else, the temperature would just go steadily up. in fact, other things are going on. El Nino comes in, and then La Nina comes in, and currents change, and all of these natural phenomena are happening on top of the human signal of climate change, which is why, for example, the rate of warming has slowed in the past over the past decade or so. And people say, well, that means climate change is not really happening because it's supposed to go up at a steady rate. Well, no, it's that human-caused climate change is happening at a certain rate, and natural forces are altering that rate. So both things at once.
And let's assume for the sake just of this discussion that a year from now, some miraculous technology comes along that allows us to no longer have to burn fossil fuels and put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And within 3 or 4 years after that, the whole world is converted. Our problems with greenhouse gases are not over at that point.
That's right, because once you put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, as I mentioned earlier, the natural processes that pull it out again are overwhelmed. And so the greenhouse gases we've already put into the atmosphere since we started burning fossil fuels in the 1800s, and especially in the last 50 years, they're up there, and they're going to stay up there. They don't break down like some chemicals might. And so they, once they're in the atmosphere, they are going to keep warming the planet for literally hundreds of years, maybe even 1,000 years. So we've already bought a certain amount of warming. And even if we stop today, we've already bought it and paid for it, and we're stuck with it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have John on the line next in Plano. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Since biblical times, we've had floods and famines and droughts, et cetera, and climate skeptics seem to, and we've had this discussion the last 20 years, and there's a lot of climate skeptics, particularly in the area of Texas, where I live, about man-made climate change. Do you foresee anything happening in the next 10 to 15 years of such a dramatic nature that people will, or that most people will say, wait a second, climate change, man-made climate change is for real and it presents a situation that we must do something about?
That's a good, very good question. I think that we're already seeing this summer with the severe heat waves and droughts and severe storms that we've had over the past summer, and in most of the U.S. we had a very warm winter last winter. People are starting to notice and say, this seems odd. And is this converting a huge number of climate skeptics? No, it's not. But it's making people who didn't really think about it before start to think about it, start to take it seriously. And if the projections by climate scientists are correct, and I think they are, I think they're close, at least close to being correct, these kind of events are going to be happening more and more often over the next 10 or 20 years. And so there's no, I don't think there will be an abrupt, sudden, you know, catastrophic event that will make everybody wake up. But I think that this evidence that people are kind of seeing out of the corner of their eye and wondering, well, could this be, are things changing, will become much more clear and obvious and harder to ignore. And I think that is actually likely to change people's minds.
So computer climate models are good as far as we can tell, but you're candid in the book that they are not perfect and they can't predict everything. Talk about the limitations of those models and how conservative estimates are based on what we know about the accuracy of computer models.
Okay, so climate models are basically simulations of the climate. They're sort of, you might think of them as virtual reality versions of the climate. Mm-hmm. And because the climate is pretty complex, and because we don't know every last detail of the forces that affect it, they can only approximately talk about what is in store for the climate. So because it's a virtual world, you can do experiments that you couldn't do in the real world. So you could say, well, let's imagine we keep pumping in carbon dioxide and don't cut back. Let's do that in our computer and see what happens to the climate. And so they do that and it comes out. But if you use different climate models created by different scientists, you actually get different answers. And that's because some models focus more on some aspects of the climate, the interaction between the air and the oceans, for example. Others focus more on other aspects of it. And so they're good at different things. And what climate modelers do is they don't take any one model and say, yep, this is exactly what's going to happen. They look at all the models together and say, collectively, what are they pointing toward? And because they come out with slightly different answers based on the assumptions that go into the climate models and the way that you represent the ocean mathematically and the way that you represent clouds mathematically, they come out with different answers for where the temperature, for example, will go or how high sea level will rise. And so they take the models and they kind of average them out and they look at the range of answers they predict, which is why when the IPCC comes out with projections, it says that we're going to go, we're probably going to gain another 1.5 to 4.5 degrees of temperature by the end of the century. That's a fairly wide range, but it represents the honesty of the climate modelers in saying we don't have any perfect model. So we kind of see where they're all kind of agreeing.
It sounds like a much more complicated version of all of us sort of doing those retirement calculators and how much money you have to save, and you try to figure what the interest rates will be and what inflation will be. It's sort of the same thing. You have to have a lot of information to sort of assume that you can at least understand the trend.
Yeah, and you have to like make a lot of assumptions. By the way, thank you. I've never heard that analogy before, but I'm going to steal it.
It's yours.
That's great.
My guest is Michael Leminick. He's senior science writer with the nonpartisan science journalism organization Climate Central. We're talking this hour about the new book he's co-authored. It's called Global Weirdness: Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Leminick. He's senior science writer for Climate Central and co-author of Global Weirdness: Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Jim on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Chris, thank you very much as always. And Michael, thank you for being nonpartisan. I think we could all use more of that these days.
Well, okay. We're happy to be here.
My question is, I recall, and it's been some time ago, but I believe I recall correctly, that ice ages are coming in about 12,500-year cycles. Do I remember this correctly? Where are we in that cycle, and how does that fit into the bigger picture?
I think the cycles are maybe as short as that, but it can be also as long as 20,000 years in between ice ages. The last ice age began to fall apart about 18,000 years ago, and it was fully ended by about 10,000 years ago. So it takes a while to go into and out of an ice age. Nobody really knows for sure exactly where we are, because this is not each one is slightly different. Back 100 years ago, one of the very original scientists who came up with the idea that carbon dioxide could cause global warming was encouraged that we were adding fossil CO2 to the atmosphere, because he thought an ice age might be around the corner and we could maybe stave it off. And even around the, you know, the 50s and 60s, people observed that the temperatures around the world seemed to be cooling, and they thought, uh-oh, is this an ice age about to begin? And in retrospect, we think that that's not what happened, that it was actually, there was so much pollution, especially around and after World War II from industrialization, that we were actually blocking out some of the sun and cooling off the planet that way, and clean air regulations in the 70s cleaned that up, and the temperature started to go back on its expected rise. So you might say, even now, wow, you know, if there's an ice age around the corner, isn't this a good thing that we're warming the planet? And it would be if we could tune it so finely as to just counteract the onset of an ice age. Problem is, we don't know if the next ice age is going to start coming on in 100 years or 1,000 years or 5,000 years. And even when it does, it'll come on very slowly. And the warming that we're triggering is coming on so fast that it's almost impossible to imagine that this would have any benefit, the fact that we're warming up the planet. We're warming much faster than an ice age could cool us down.
We have an email here from Mickey in Addison who says, if the world is getting warmer, isn't that better than if the world were getting colder?
Well, you know, it all depends on how much warmer, how fast, how much colder, how fast. You know, any drastic change in our current climate in either direction is problematic for the reasons I mentioned before, that we are pretty well adapted to the current climate, and any change that goes faster than we can move our cities and move our highways and move our entire infrastructure is a bad thing. So I don't think better or worse is the right or warmer or cooler is the right question here.
How can we expect climate change to affect disease as it touches the human population?
So the question of disease, there are a couple of things. One is that the increase in heat waves and hot weather generally has a very bad effect on people who already have chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease or lung disease, especially the elderly. Heat stress can actually combine with these diseases to kill people, literally. Mm-hmm. The other thing we worry about is the spread of infectious diseases that are carried by insects especially, have ranges where they're places where they're endemic, and that's because the climate is appropriate and comfortable for these insects. And so diseases like malaria or dengue fever or West Nile virus.
We're dealing with that. We're in the throes of dealing with that here in North Texas as we speak.
West Nile?
Yeah. Yeah.
Ah, okay. And so as the climate becomes more accommodating to the insects that carry those diseases, they will expand into new territories. The disease-carrying insects will expand into new territory and could theoretically spread diseases to a wider range of people. The thing to remember there is, just as I talked about human and natural cycles of climate working at the same time and interfering with each other in some ways, the range of an insect is not the only thing that governs how widespread it's going to be. Malaria was an endemic disease in the United States right into the early part of the 1900s. You know, Washington was a terrible place for malaria. New Jersey, which seems like the North, we had plenty of malaria here. So the climate was already fine for those insects. The reason we don't have malaria anymore is that we have a strong public health system and we drained the swamps and made it inhospitable for other reasons. So it's going to be a combination of changing climate and pressure on the public health system that will affect the spread of infectious disease.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Ryan in Dallas. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to learn more about carbon sequestration, I guess is the word. But I was curious if the guest knows any promising strategies for sequestering carbon from the atmosphere.
Yeah, so carbon sequestration is the idea that when you burn fossil fuels like coal, before the carbon dioxide has a chance to enter the atmosphere, you grab it through some chemical process and liquefy it and pump it underground into a formation where it'll stay for thousands of years. And if it doesn't go into the atmosphere, then it doesn't matter how much coal you burn, you're not going to add greenhouse gases. You're not going to warm the Earth. And this has been done on a very modest scale in a number of places, and it seems to work pretty well. There are two problems with it. One is that to sequester all of the carbon it would take to really make a dent in our greenhouse situation would take an enormous scaling up. And you'd have to find a lot of places to store this stuff, a lot of formations. And the formations, underground formations, are not ideal necessarily where you're burning the most coal. So you'd have to pump this stuff around the country. So that's one problem. And the other problem is that it costs some money to add this equipment and it costs energy to actually take the carbon out of the smokestack, which makes the production of energy more expensive. And, you know, again, people don't want to spend more money than they absolutely have to. So in one sense, it's very promising. We have a pretty good idea that it can be done, and we have some pretty good ideas of how to do it and where to put the stuff. But it's not ready for prime time yet, and it's going to make energy more expensive.
It certainly sounds like, despite whatever best efforts people might be making as individuals to change their consumption habits and to try and be responsible about their carbon footprint, that it would take more than just individual action to make a difference. Can you talk a little bit about the role that you see public policy having to play in order to get a handle on all of this?
Yeah, I think that the real problem is there are things that individuals can do. You know, you can replace your light bulbs, and you can buy a Prius, and you can insulate your house and all that stuff, and inflate your tires. But individual decisions, and for enough people to make enough individual decisions about enough things in their lives to really put a dent in carbon emissions, imagines a kind of a willingness and a being on board with this whole thing that doesn't really seem to be realistic to me.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who will say, no, you know, I want to help the environment and I want to do my part, and darn it, I'm going to go out and buy an efficient car. A lot of people are not going to think that way. Not because they're, you know, they hate the environment, but they're just worried about other things.
Right.
And they don't want to spend extra money if they don't have to. It's not a great time in the economy. So it seems pretty clear to me that without government intervention, like raising fuel economy standards on cars, or like making people pay a penalty. People and businesses pay a penalty for emitting carbon. Nothing really is going to happen on a large scale. And, you know, if we put a tax or a price on carbon and said, look, if you emit a certain amount of carbon, you've got to pay this fine, that's a very powerful incentive in a free enterprise system for people to say, okay, I'm going to find a better way to do it. I'm going to, it's in my financial interest to save carbon, to emit less carbon. And I don't think that substantial change is going to happen until that kind of thing comes into play.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Judy in Irving. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest, I'm currently reading Gilding's book, The Great Disruption, and in his book he says that something big will happen, even though I know that this author says he doesn't think so. Gilding says that something really big is going to happen and that it will get everyone's attention and get governments on board. Do you think that could happen, and is there any good news for us?
Did he say what it was?
No, Gilding says something will happen. It will be so big that it will get the attention of so many voters that it will cause the government to move.
Well, it's sort of hard to respond to something that vague. I wish he would say what he means, and then I could react to it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to say. I don't know what that could be. So,
well, the other half of Judy's question is there any good news in all of this?
Well, is there any good news in all of this? That's a very good question. I don't know. The good news is that whether it's from this mysterious single catastrophe or a growing realization by people based on one little disaster after another that this is a real threat to lives and property, that enough bad stuff will happen that we will do something about it. So I guess if that's good news, I will go with that.
So let me ask you this. After the colon in your title, things are pretty pretty scary. Severe storms, deadly heat waves, relentless drought, rising seas. But the tone of the book itself is frankly less alarmist than a lot of other books we've done on the subject on this show. Can you talk about who your target audience is and what you hope this book will do?
Yes, we deliberately did take that straightforward tone. And it's because people have been doing alarmism for quite a while. People have been saying we're all doomed, and it's, you know, alarmism has been tried. As far as I can tell, it hasn't done much good.
Mm-hmm.
I've been covering climate change literally since 1987, believe it or not, and we've done alarmism, and things are. We've got now 25 years later, far more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere than ever before. No significant action. Alarmism scares people, but it doesn't, I don't think, inspire the majority of people to take action. Especially because you look around and the world is really not that different than it's ever been. Yeah, it's a terrible heat wave, but we've had heat waves, and it just doesn't look like a catastrophe happening. And then to say, you know, the world is ending, and people look around, and it's not ending. It's not very persuasive. I'm hoping this book will speak to the large number of people kind of in the middle. They're not activists. They're not skeptics. They're people who keep hearing about climate change and hear confusing messages from different sides of the argument and hear, you know, messages of doom and messages that there's nothing happening and are frankly confused. It's something they feel like they should know more about, but you know, it's what do you believe? And we wanted to take a calm tone and acknowledge skeptics' arguments and address them calmly, so as to convince people that there is something going on. You don't have to run out screaming from the room, but it's something serious you need to think about.
Michael Lemonick is senior science writer for Climate Central and co-author of Global Weirdness, Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. Michael, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
It's been my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free every day at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.